Thank you very much, Jens, for your excellent remarks and for your leadership in steering NATO in a very difficult times. Now we have around half an hour, and I will be opening the debate, so you can ask questions physically. So catch my eye, raise your hand, and I will try to distribute the questions. You can also use the online app Slido, where you can post questions, and I will be going back and forth here. But in the meantime, before I give you the floor or give you some time for thinking about the questions, let me use the opportunity that I'm the moderator and ask the first question. And that comes from President Donald Trump. He has several times said that NATO is obsolete, and he's pushing European allies to invest more. You met several times with Donald Trump. You have met with Mike Pompeo and other U.S. leaders, and Donald Trump as well. What was your answer to him?
He gave me actually the answer to that question at our first press conference, because I visited the White House, I think it was a couple of months after he became president in 2017. And then we had a joint press conference, President Trump and I. And I remember he, and you can look it up on YouTube or you can watch it yourself. He says at that press conference in the press statement that President Trump says that I used to say that NATO is obsolete, but NATO is not longer obsolete. So he was very clear about that. He thought that NATO has been able to change. And especially in two areas, we have stepped up our efforts in the fight against terrorism. NATO allies and NATO are a member of the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, and we have made, all of us together, have made enormous progress in defeating ISIS. This is extremely important for our security, for all of us, and NATO has been part of that. The other reason why the president recognizes the progress we have made is, of course, that he sees that NATO allies, European NATO allies and Canada, are now investing more. We all have to agree that we need fair burden sharing. When we stand together, protect each other, then we have to all to carry our part of the burden. And the reality is that the GDP, the national income of the United States, is almost exactly as big as the GDP of all European NATO allies and Canada together. So in theory, we should pay approximately the same. But the United States has defense expenditure which are more than twice as big as the total defense expenditure of all other NATO allies and Canada. So therefore, NATO allies agreed in 2014 that we need to do something with that. We cannot continue with such an imbalanced burden sharing. And the good news is that over the last years, we have seen a significant increase in defense spending from European allies and Canada. Just since 2016, and by the end of next year, 2020, they will have added $100 billion extra U.S. dollars for their defense spending. So that's also the reason why President Trump is now clear about that NATO is not longer obsolete. NATO is important. NATO is important for Europe, but it's also extremely important for the United States. So we just have to continue to make sure that we have fair burden sharing in the alliance.
Thank you very much. Do you want to react on this?
I can add, I met with Secretary Pompeo twice, and in both meetings he expressed very strong support and obviously understanding of the role and importance of NATO. In my meeting with President Trump, he did not raise the NATO as an issue and as a problem, but the fact is, as Secretary General just referred to, that it was difficult, and it has been difficult to explain to President Trump why the United States should pay for like 75% of the overall budget of NATO. And the fact is that this has been a voluntary commitment, unwritten rule, that the allies, the members of NATO, should contribute like 2% of their GDP to invest in defense. And we have never done that before, and we were not the only ones. And therefore, this issue was put on the agenda of NATO summit in Wales so long before arrival of Donald Trump in 2014. President Obama said that this is no longer serious, that actually the defense spending is declining rather than increasing. Slovakia, for all these years, was investing around 1% of our GDP to NATO. But it's like free ride. So you want to be part of the collective defense, but you don't want to do your share. That's not fair. I mean, if you order a taxi, you pay your bill. So President Trump used his style and his language to remind us all of our commitments. And at the same time, it's not President Trump or the United States ordering us to do. This is the commitment we were well aware of, and we have accepted voluntarily 15 years ago. And I'm glad that we are now doing what we were supposed to do. So in 2014, our defense spending was 1.1% GDP. This year, it's 1.73. And as I said, we adopted a commitment or made a commitment to reach 2% by 2024, but we are going to do it 2 years ahead of the time. 2022, Slovakia will reach the 2% of defense spending. And I really believe that it's only fair.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So I would like to open the floor for your questions. It's always very difficult to be the first icebreaker.
I have to say it's only in Slovakia. I'm attending many discussions like this in many countries all over the world, and people are eagerly waiting for the chance to ask questions. And there are so many hands raised already. But in Slovakia, we are so shy. No one wants to be first. No one wants to be special. So go ahead, don't be shy.
There is the first. But I have to tell you that I have plenty of questions already on Slido. So there are a lot of questions in the meantime. I see already. So now you provoke the two hands. Please, on this side, on the left side. Andre.
But I'm happy to pass the question to somebody from the audience, because I'm not important here, so I was just wanting to break the ice. So
you
go ahead.
You are a great journalist. Okay.
So I have rather a philosophical question for Mr. Secretary General.
Could you please stand up so we can
stand
see
up,
you?
Yes.
So, Mr. Secretary General, democracy, freedom, and the sanctity of the individual are core Western values and the foundation of our societies. Do you believe they are also universal? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I believe those values are universal values, and they're also core values for NATO. It's actually in our founding treaty that NATO is based on democracy, individual liberty, and the rule of law. So, yes?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me pose you the question that came from Michal at Slido. In light of recent developments in Syria and the U.S. back and forth on troops withdrawals, how much of a threat that does NATO perceive ISIS to remain in the future? Mr. Secretary General.
So ISIS have lost control over the territory they controlled just a few years ago. And as I said, a territory that was big, same size as the United Kingdom, 8 million people, and they were actually able to threaten Baghdad. So if NATO allies, the global coalition to defeat Daesh or ISIS, and NATO, if we hadn't acted, Then we would have seen a very, very dangerous and difficult situation in the whole region, Iraq and Syria. Because of our military efforts, we have been able to degrade and make sure that they don't control territory. That doesn't mean that ISIS is not longer a threat, because they are going on the ground. They are responsible for terrorist attacks. They are trying to operate in other ways, both in Syria and Iraq, but also other places in the world. They have different, organizations and cells and so on in other countries. For instance, in Afghanistan, we see ISIS there, ISIS Khorasan. We have seen them in Africa and so on. So this fight is a generational fight. It is not over, but we have achieved something which is very important. we have deprived them from the territory they controlled and also the income they had from that, that territory. NATO is not on the ground in Syria. Some NATO allies are. We are focusing on the fight against terrorism in different ways, but I think one of the main lessons we have learned from Iraq, from Afghanistan and elsewhere, is that sometimes NATO has to be able to deploy a big number of combat troops in big combat operations. But in the long run, it's better if we are able to train local forces to stabilize their own country. And therefore, we are now more and more focused on how can we help the Afghans to stabilize their own country? How can we help the Iraqis to stabilize their own country and fight terrorism themselves? Because we will always be foreigners. We will always be foreign troops in a foreign country. Sometimes we need to do that. But in the long run, it's much better if we can train local forces. That's the reason why our mission in Afghanistan, now it's not longer a combat mission, but a train, assist and advise mission to train the Afghans to enable to stabilize their own country. And that's the reason why we are now actually in the process of building up a new training mission in Iraq to help them train and develop local capacity to fight Daesh or ISIS themselves. So that battle is not over, but we have achieved something that was very important. We have taken away the territory from Daesh that they controlled until recently.
Thank you very much. Unless I see some hands here, let me go to Slido, to the second question I see here. And let me pose this to you, Mr. Minister. There is a question. How do you perceive the rise of pro-Russian sentiments in the CEE region? Is that a real threat?
Well, there is a real threat, not in a security sense or military sense, but in a sense of confusion. Yeah, there is an alternative truth to everything. And it is growing, it is more and more present here. And as a reality, then as people are confused, so therefore it's so important to communicate and to be transparent in our actions and to be able to explain what we do and how we do it. And yes, we are partly responsible for that. I mean, I never start by blaming the other party. We should start from ourselves. And the fact is that our communication has become too complicated, too technical for people to understand. And this is particularly the case for the European Union. So people lost the feeling that the EU, the institutions are there to deal with their problems, to protect them. It looked like the institutions locked themselves into their own world using very complicated language and addressing issues that people would not feel as their problems. So and that was immediately used and cleverly used. So therefore, we need communication, we need clarity, we need credibility, and we need transparency.
Thank you. This is also connected to the spread of misinformation, and also that is causing, in many times, erosion of trust in Western institutions, because the goal of misinformation is not to win the argument, but to decrease the trust in the system. How is NATO dealing with it? Is it a threat that we can lose trust of the people from inside?
Well, the purpose of disinformation is, of course, to undermine trust in our democratic institutions. And we have seen examples of efforts to meddle in the democratic processes in several NATO allied countries with different means, with cyber, with disinformation, with using social media. And we are very much aware of that. NATO helps to counter that in different ways, partly by, you know, countering disinformation when we see it, online, on paper, in the air, also in different media platforms. But at the same, and we strongly believe that the answer to propaganda is not, or disinformation is not more propaganda or more disinformation, but the answer to propaganda is, from NATO side, it's facts. It's the truth. Because we are confident that in the long run, the truth will prevail. Then we also strongly believe that this is not only a responsibility for NATO. We work together with the European Union. And, of course, at the end of the day, it's very much also a responsibility for each and every member state. Of course, NATO can help Slovakia to address this information in Slovakia, but the best people to address this information in Slovakia are people in Slovakia, Slovaks themselves. We can help, we can assist, we can share experiences, we can learn from each other, but at the end of the day, this is something you have to deal with here. The last thing I'm going to say about this is that I think the best way to deal with disinformation, propaganda, misuse of social media, is to have a free, independent press. To have journalists that ask the difficult questions, journalists and media which are able to check their sources, because then in the long run this will be exposed as what it is, attempts to meddle, attempt to mislead. So we need open, transparent discussions. We need free and independent media. In that kind of societies, disinformation will never survive.
If I may.
Yeah, please.
Yes, because I feel very strongly about this. Because unfortunately, we hear voices in Slovakia questioning NATO and the European Union and our membership in that. So my suggestion to you is every time someone approaches you with this criticism, ask them, what's the alternative? Tell me what's the better alternative. With NATO, we have guarantees of security and peace. With the European Union, we have guarantees of prosperity and protection of our human rights. And if someone says, we don't need NATO because we are secure, isn't it the other way around? We are secure because we are members of NATO? If people say, why aren't we neutral? My question is, who would guarantee our neutrality? Why? What for? So we, country like Slovakia, with our size, population, and geographical location, can only be strong when we are part of a wider environment which is based on principles of values. And there is no other alternative, no better alternative. I mean, there are other alternatives, but they are bad alternatives. There is no better alternative for this country than to be a trustworthy and credible member of the European Union and NATO.
Thank you very much. This is a very strong message. So in the meantime, just catch my eye or just raise your hands as we go in the discussion. But there is another question that I very much like, because both of you have mentioned the 2%. And it has become a buzzword from the U.S. president, but also in Europe. This is a never-ending story. You said, Mr. Secretary General, that money matters, but what we do with the money is even more important. And there might be a gap between U.S. and Europe on the level of spending, but also how we spend the money. Do we spend the money in Europe efficiently enough, or what should we do better?
So first, I think we have to remember that the 2%, the guideline or the goal which has been established by NATO to spend 2% of gross domestic product on defense, is not something which is invented by the United States. It's something which is agreed by 29 allies. And we reiterated that pledge at the summit where all NATO leaders were together. As late as at our summit in Brussels in July last year. And I have been a politician in Norway for many years, and I understand very well that most politicians, or actually all politicians, they prefer to spend money on something else than defense. They would like to spend money on education, on health, on infrastructure, instead of spending money on defense. And therefore also, all European allies, they reduced defense spending after the end of the Cold War in the 1990s and the beginning of 2000. Defense spending was going down in Norway, my own country, in Slovakia, and most of other countries, because we felt more safe. We saw tensions were going down, and then we spent more money on health and education instead of defense. But my message is that when we reduce defense spending, when tensions are going down, we have to be able to increase defense spending when tensions are going up as they are now. To make sure that we still deliver credible deterrence to preserve the peace. Last thing I would say, because now I see there are some questions, is that I think that one of the challenges in Europe is that we have a very fragmented way of spending money. In the United States, they have one main battle tank. And of course, then they have the economy scale. The cost of producing one, if you have a large number, is smaller than if you have a smaller number of units you produce. Maintenance, training, and so on also becomes much cheaper. In Europe, there are seven different types of main battle tanks. So it's a much more fragmentation. This is the case for all different weapon platforms. So the cost of maintaining the European defense is much higher than the United States. So that's actually add to the imbalance when it comes to burden sharing. Mm.
Thank you very much. And I see a question at the back on the left side, and then another question here in the front.
Thank you very much for the word. Mr. General Secretary, I would like to ask a question regarding the enhanced forward presence units of NATO in the Baltic states, as the Slovak troops are also part of this mission. How well do you think are the units of this mission prepared in case of Russia decides to undertake some military action against Baltic countries? And also that leads to the second part of my question, if it has more of a practical value or is this a political statement to let the Russians know that we are here and we are prepared to undertake we are ready to use any means necessary in order to secure the security of those Baltic states. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What you refer to, just to explain to those who don't know the details, is that NATO has deployed four battle groups, four battalions in the three Baltic states and Poland. We did that in 2016, I think it was, and before that we didn't have any combat-ready presence in the eastern part of the alliance. This is very important because we have to make sure that nothing like what we have seen in Georgia, where Russia used force against Georgia in 2008, or like we have seen, for instance, in Crimea or Donbas, can happen to any NATO ally. And to just make sure that there is no doubt about that, we have deployed these four battle groups, roughly 1,000 each of them, a bit more, so totally about close to 5,000 soldiers. We have deployed these battle groups, and we also have some presence in Romania and the Black Sea region. These battle groups are combat ready. They are extremely important because they send a clear message that any kind of aggression against one of these countries will trigger the whole response from the whole alliance, because the whole alliance is already there. There's no way, in a way, you can do something to be responsible for aggression against Latvia or Lithuania without meeting NATO, because NATO is already there. Then, of course, I agree that 1,000 soldiers is not that much. Well, they're well-trained, well-equipped. But second, they represent the whole alliance. And we have the battle groups. We have, of course, the national forces of the different Baltic countries. And then we have the ability to reinforce. And the way NATO functions is that if we see a need, we will reinforce quickly to make sure that we can defend any ally. But again, the message is that we want to prevent the conflict. And the best way to prevent a conflict is to avoid any misunderstanding, any power vacuum, as long as there is no reason to for miscalculations, then there will be no war, no conflict, and we can still live in peace.
Mm. I would add one sentence, which is important also for Slovak public, that NATO is present in the Baltic states because they requested the presence. So it's not that NATO enforce itself upon those countries, because I'm now being currently accused by some people of negotiating behind the back of our public creation of NATO base in, or US base in Slovakia. It's not true. We are not negotiating, we are not preparing to set up any base, and there will be no base unless we ask for it. NATO, we are partners in NATO, so NATO does not make decision without consulting with us. So this is very important to understand.
And maybe I would just add that as we are members of NATO, all our troops are NATO troops, and all our bases are NATO bases. Our bases are NATO bases as everyone else. So, but I've seen a question here at in the front.
My name is Elena Kutsko. I come from Bratislava. Thank you very much for coming here. I have a question about the topic that was briefly mentioned already today, but could you please elaborate a little bit more about the role of advanced technologies such as artificial intelligence for security? Is it something that doesn't let you sleep at night, or not yet, particularly knowing that countries like China or Russia don't have any problems striving to integrate it into the security domain? And maybe Minister Lajcik, in the similar vein, could you please help us understand, because we are very worried that, for example, Americans are much more advanced than us Europeans in this area, and we're just concerned that we're going to become not able, we will not be able to work together. What a country, a small country like Slovakia, can do to stay relevant? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the very excellent question on artificial intelligence.
Historically, NATO has always been in the lead when it comes to technology. We have always had a technological edge, meaning that the most advanced technologies, the most advanced weapon systems have always been developed by NATO and NATO allies. And of course, the United States has been key because of the size. Now we see that we are challenged, for instance, by China when it comes to the use of artificial intelligence. For me, that requires two sets of responses. One is that we also are investing in technology, artificial intelligence, for instance. That's one of the reasons why we believe it is important to also increase defense spending, because this is not only about increasing more, spending more, but also about making sure that 20% of the defense budget is used for investments and research and technology, because we need research and development, because we need new technologies. And there is enormous potential when it comes to, for instance, artificial intelligence, big data, and many other kinds of technologies. The other, so we need to keep the, maintain the technological edge. The other challenge is to try to develop mechanisms to avoid an arms race with these new technologies. That's not so easy, but we were able to develop, you know, very even during the coldest period of the Cold War, at least in the 60s and the 70s, the two superpowers, the Soviet Union and United States, the Warsaw Pact and NATO, were able to agree on ways to limit the number of nuclear weapons and actually gradually start to reduce the number of nuclear weapons, which was the most advanced weapons at that time. And that was a great achievement, partly because we then prevented a very, very costly arms race to become even more costly, and partly because when you reduce the number of nuclear weapons, we reduce the risk of any nuclear weapons being used. Now we need to look into how can we develop systems, agreements, regimes which are controlling these new technologies to try to limit or reduce the potential for a new arms race. I'm saying we don't have all the answers to this now, but at least we need to discuss, look into it, because it's a totally different world where we use that kind of technologies as part of our new weapon systems.
Thank you very much, Mr. Minister.
The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, says that there are three most important global challenges of today and that will shape our future. First one is the climate change and our ability to deal with it. The second one is massive movement of people and our ability to manage it. And the third one is what is called digital revolution or utilization of new technologies, artificial intelligence. And this will decide who will be the winner and the loser of the 21st century. And you are absolutely right. The Americans are way more advanced than we Europeans and Slovakia as part of the European Union. There is no chance for us to compete on our own. So it's like the hard defense. We have to be part of the wider endeavor, a wider effort, and we have to contribute our fair share to this effort. Europe is competitive. What we need, and the Secretary General spoke about it, referring to the defense, to the hard defense, but it also goes when it comes to science, technology, research. We are too fragmented. So we have the Germans, we have the French, we have the others. We need to join forces and to do more European research and European projects, for which Slovakia has to be part of it. We must not let the train leave the station without us. And then we can benefit from the results, from the outcomes. And it's really important that everybody understands that these are the issues that will define our future.
Thank you very much. There are plenty of questions here, but I prefer if there are hands in the room. So I see a question at the back of the room.
Dear Mr. Secretary General, my name is Sergei. I'm from Russia, Moscow. I'm studying here in Slovakia. First of all, I'm very pleased to be here, and thank you for this opportunity. My question is, as you mentioned before, that Russia is waging war in Ukraine, but the only evidence of this is Mr. Poroshenko's Ukrainian president show at United Nations Congress, where he showed Russian passports of Russian troops, but we all understand it's, we can take it as an evidence. And the second part of my question is, if NATO has all the army and resources to stop war in Ukraine, why can't NATO came to Ukraine and help Ukrainian troops to stop this war, because they're fighting like the regular separatists from Donbas? Thank you.
First, I think we have to remember that we have many, many different treaties which Russia, NATO allies have signed onto, which guarantee the international recognized borders of every nation in Europe, but especially Ukraine. We have, for instance, the Budapest Agreement, I think it was back in 1994, where explicitly recognized Ukraine within its international recognized border, which includes Crimea. Now Crimea is annexed by Russia. So there's no doubt that that Russia has used aggression against Crimea. We saw what they was then called little green men, but that was actually Russian soldiers, special operations soldiers, and later on this Crimea was annexed by Russia, violating the international recognized borders of an independent country. It is not only Petro Poroshenko, President Petro Poroshenko, but we have from open media sources, we have from intelligence, we have from many different sources that Russia is present and supporting the separatists in Donbas, in eastern Ukraine. So there's no doubt about that. And at least what they could help us to do was to control the border between Russia and eastern Ukraine. They don't want to help us to do that. And I think one of the reasons is that they then will not be able to operate as freely as they do between Russia and eastern Ukraine. NATO, then I didn't fully understand the last part of your question, but we are working for a peaceful solution. We want the full implementation of the Minsk agreements, ceasefire, withdrawal of heavy weapons, and also allow the international monitors, representing an organization called OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, to allow them to operate freely and safely in eastern Ukraine or Donbas. This is the only way to a peaceful solution, and NATO strongly supports those efforts. We also help and support Ukraine with some capacity building, with some help with cyber, with the logistics, with the command structure. But the main message is that we need a peaceful, negotiated solution to the conflict in Ukraine.
Let me just add, because there is a question here: is it possible for Ukraine to join NATO, and if, when?
The main message there is that it is for the 29 allies and the applicant country to decide if and when to join. No one else has a say. Because very often I hear that, you know, if Ukraine joins, or if North Macedonia joins, or if Georgia joins, that's a provocation against Russia. It's an aggressive action against Russia. Just that concept is totally wrong. Because I strongly believe that every nation has the right to decide its own path. And NATO totally respect that, regardless of whether they work for membership in NATO or they say we are neutral. We have, for instance, Sweden and Finland, close partners of Austria, close partners of NATO. They have decided to be neutral. We respect that 110%. No problem. If they want to be neutral, be neutral. But we also respect when nations, through democratic processes, decide that they want to join NATO, like, for instance, Montenegro did recently, or North Macedonia now are in the process of doing. Then we respect that decision. It's not a provocation against the neighbor. The whole idea that this is a provocation against the neighbor is that big states, big nations, big powers have the right to decide what small neighbors do. That's very dangerous. And especially, again, coming from not a very big country like Slovakia or not a very big country like Norway, if we start to talk and respect the idea of sphere of influence, that big powers can decide what small neighbors do, then we are in a very, very dangerous world. That is the world we try to leave behind. And again, speaking on behalf of the country I'm coming from, Norway joined NATO in 1949. Josef Stalin was very much against that. He didn't like that. But I'm very glad that that United States, United Kingdom, and the other NATO allies in 49 said, well, Norway is a small country, they want to join, welcome. Despite the fact that Josef Stalin didn't like it. So the answer is that, well, these countries will join when 29 allies, as the members of today, and that country decide on that. No one else has the right to interfere.
And I would add one sentence. You mentioned the spheres of influence, and we know something about it, because 50 years ago, 1968, when Warsaw Pact troops invaded Czechoslovakia, the West didn't care. Why? Because it all happened within the Soviet sphere of influence.
Yeah.
So it was like they can do whatever they want as long as it is within their sphere of influence. I'm profoundly against spheres of influence, because that means that the big ones decide about the fate of the small ones. We will never be the big country. So what we need is a system which is based on rules, and the rules must be respected by everyone. Otherwise, we will always be, not free, and our fate, our future will be decided by others. So that's why we really have to insist on a system which is based on international law and on rules that apply universally.
Thank you very much for both of you. There are a lot of questions on cybersecurity, India-Pakistan conflict, Kosovo, and many others that we received in the meantime. We are unable to answer them because we are out of time. I see another hand here. We are very sorry, unless you say that we can take one more question.
You can take him.
Okay.
It has to be easy question now.
My name is Sure, and I have a question regarding China. Nowadays, from everywhere, we can hear that Chinese companies are trying to buy out European and North American companies. In your opinion, Secretary General, can it lead to a security breach? And if so, does NATO have a plan to prevent these breaches?
Security breaches.
I
think that we see a great potential for cooperation with China. China is a rising power, strong economy, and there is a potential to work with China in many different areas. At the same time, we see some challenges. For instance, when it comes to critical infrastructure, and I think the reality is that we now have to analyze how to deal with that. NATO allies are, for instance, addressing the issue related to 5G networks and Huawei. They have not concluded, but in one way or another, NATO allies need to address that challenge. So I don't have the final answer with two lines under the answer, but we are very much aware of both the potential for working with China, but also some of the challenges related to, for instance, some critical infrastructure and advanced technologies.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the last question. Thank you for all of you who joined our debate today, and for both you, Jens, and Miroslav, for joining us here in Košice. I wish you a safe travel home or back to Brussels and to Bratislava. And thank you for your great leadership in NATO and in Slovakia, because leaders like you are making us more secure, and we can sleep a little bit better in this very dangerous world. Thank you very much.